For some people, it's really not the most wonderful time of the year. It's that time again where your family may be flying in to stay for the week, the kids are home from school, they're running up that credit card bill, and long lines in traffic and at the mall, and before you know it, your heart is pumping, your veins in your neck are bulging, your palms are sweating, and you're just one expletive deleted away from getting into a fist fight with a guy who thought that lines were just for suckers. What I'm talking about, of course, is stress. Science is telling us that stress can dampen your immune system, stifle creativity, and even shorten your life. So as this holiday season is on us, we're going to be looking at stress in a couple of different ways. First, from the kind of that we all feel while we're waiting line, you know, that line that's too long, to also to the kind that we hope we never feel, and that's the stress of a hurricane, a tornado, or terrorism, or war, different kind of stress. Why do people, some people, go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder while others do not? Can traumatic stress harm you and your heart? These are some of the things we'll be talking about this hour. And if you're here in the audience with us, I invite you to step up to the microphone and ask a question here at the American Psychological Association Science Leadership Conference, where we are in Washington today. And if you're in your car, in the cell, or at home, our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you're invited to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Janice Kiecolt-Glaser is the S. Robert Davis Chair of Medicine and a Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology at Ohio State University School of Medicine. Thank you for being with us today. David Krantz is Professor and Chairman of the Department of Medical and Clinical Psychology at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. Thank you for dropping by today.
Happy to be here.
Wendy Barry Mendes is the Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Ira.
And Faris Tuma is Chief of the Traumatic Stress Research Program at the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, in Bethesda, which is part of NIH, as you know. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's define some ground rules, Dr. Kiecolt-Glaser. Did I define stress, the pumping heart, all that kind of stuff correctly? It's got to be different for everybody, right?
It is different for everybody. You know, one of the broad definitions is it's an individual response, and broadly the perception that the challenges you're facing exceed your ability to cope.
That when you can't cope, the stress goes up.
Absolutely.
So part of then combating stress would be finding a way to cope with it.
That's the ideal.
And it doesn't seem so easy when you're sitting in that line. And got, you know, I love that. A lot of times it's at the toll booth. Somebody thinks that, you know, they have a special right to some other place.
Indeed.
Yeah. Let's talk about Dr. Mendes. Can you measure a person's actual response, I mean, to stress? I mean, we've seen, you know, I guess a polygraph is something that we all think about when we measure stress, but other ways.
So stress responses have been successfully measured for several years, and researchers have focused on different biological systems. So you can focus on the autonomic nervous system. That's what people would think about when they're thinking of lie detection and polygraphing. You can look at somebody's respiration, their heart rate, their vasoconstriction at the arterioles. And what research has learned is that there's really two different types of stress responses. The stress response that we think of, that you described in the beginning,
right. That
sort of defeat response that Dr. Kiecolt-Glaser described. But there's also stress responses that are associated with approach, positive stress. We talked about this, researchers talked about it 50 years ago, and talked about it as eustress, the stress that actually is associated with resiliency, better cognitive performance, and maybe even protection from disease.
Or sports response when you're playing. That would
absolutely
be positive.
Right. So you can imagine 15 years ago when you started the show, you might have had increases in cardiovascular responses, vasoconstriction, more sweat gland activity. But I wouldn't predict that you have that same response today, that you actually might have changes in your autonomic response, but those changes probably make you perform better, mm-hmm. think clearer and more creatively.
Mm-hmm. So you've learned to channel that stress to a more useful thing.
The idea is to change the negative stress response, sometimes called threat, into more of a challenge response, an approach response.
Mm-hmm. David Krantz,
but
we hear people, stress affecting people's heart attacks, things like that.
Yes.
Could be negative.
It can be negative. What I like to just go back to the last question, the way I like to think about good stress and bad stress is that when humans developed, there were physiologic responses that developed, and at the time of cavemen and women, this kind of intense arousal and physiologic response and fight or flight was a very adaptive response to being attacked by animals or fights among tribes or whatever. In today's world, that may not be so adaptive in some circumstances, and it may be adaptive, that same physiologic response, in others. And where it's adaptive tends to be where it's good. Not always, but that's kind of a general rule.
I'm sorry.
And in terms of stress in the heart, the exciting thing, talking about physiology, about work in this area, is that we've gone beyond just naming characteristics and characteristics of the individual, of the environment, to actually understanding what goes on to get these characteristics beneath the skin, so to speak, and how the behavior interacts with physiology. So you have personal characteristics that have been studied by epidemiologists, like hostility or what used to be called what's still called type A behavior.
Right.
You have symptoms of depression. And those are all personal characteristics. But there are also things in the environment that have been linked to development of coronary disease. One factor which is not always thought of as psychological is socioeconomic status. Very powerful, inverse relationship, low SES, high coronary disease. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason linking socioeconomic status and disease is thought to be psychological characteristics, behavioral characteristics. And then you have things like occupational stress in the environment. And another very important factor is low social support. So, for example, if you have your family, other people can be stressors, and other people can also relieve stress by giving you comfort, by giving you the things that you need.
Dr. Toomey, you study extreme stress that people might experience in life, hurricanes, terrorist attacks, war. Is the body's response to these events the same as they might be as waiting online, Christmas shopping or something?
I think it's very important we make this distinction that when people use the word traumatic stress, they're referring to experiences that are beyond our sort of normal daily encounters, positive or negative. We're talking about experiences where somebody fears very seriously for their physical safety and or for their life. And people who develop a condition like post-traumatic stress disorder, it's also important to point out that we're talking about relatively a minority of people who are experiencing some kind of horrible trauma. Mm-hmm. The reality is the vast majority of people who have an experience like being physically attacked or living through a hurricane or being involved in a war in a combat situation experience some of the symptoms, at least acutely, and we can talk more about what those symptoms are. But by and large, they tend to diminish over time, weeks, months. The real concern, of course, is for people where they don't diminish. And one of the hallmark features of this condition is this inability to control the fear response subsequent once the danger has already passed.
Would we all agree that that it is well known in medical literature or even in clinical situations that stress hurts your body? I mean, could it lower your immunity? You get colds or being sick, Dr. Kickel Glaser?
Absolutely. There's just growing evidence about how important stress is and what it does to the immune response. Even something as simple as a vaccine, if you're more stressed, you may take longer to develop a protective response following vaccination, or you may not even develop it in some cases. People heal wounds more slowly when they're stressed. And one of the growing trends in one of the hot numbers is inflammatory responses related to things like cardiovascular disease, arthritis, type 2 diabetes, which also is clearly exacerbated by stress.
Dr. Toomey?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because one of the privileges I have at working at NIH in reading other people's science and other people's studies is I get to learn about things as they're evolving. And one of the things that we're going to learn in the very near future and will become hopefully more well known is that having a condition like PTSD, although as I mentioned it happens in a small percentage of people who are traumatized, is probably going to turn out to be a very significant risk factor for conditions like heart disease for somebody once they get into their 40s and early 50s. This is something that has not been given a great deal of attention, at least in the psychiatric and psychological literature.
That's interesting, because I was at a conference yesterday at MIT where they were talking about stress a little bit, stress research, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the researchers got up, I think it was from Emory, and he said, you know, there's as much post-traumatic stress disorder in the inner cities as there are returning veterans. There's a tremendous amount of violence that goes on in inner cities, from rapes, muggings, beatings, things like this, that you're seeing levels even higher than you're seeing from soldiers who return. And that if you don't recognize this, you're going to miss this in a clinical situation.
I think there's probably a lot of people trying to treat problems with stomach aches and headaches and dizziness and GI problems, and they're missing the fact that there's an underlying anxiety condition in their patients.
1-800-989-8255. Could there be other diseases that we are missing that we don't know that they're stress caused, Dr. Kiko Glaser? Or Dr. Mendez, you want to answer?
Well, there was an interesting paper that came out last year that actually showed that perceived stress can accelerate cellular aging. So it appears that people that rate their life as more stressful, the proteins that cap chromosomal ends made the people look biologically older. So in
is that like your hair turns white? I mean, does that really
happen?
Right.
I mean, the idea is, how does stress get under the skin? And what's interesting about that research is it opens up a door to studying age-related effects that might have stress as an indirect mechanism. So we might be looking at diseases that have an etiology that we think is age-related, but might just be related to exacerbated stress in one's life.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna come back. We have a lot more time to talk about stress, and we'll get to all your questions and more panelists and you in the audience on that at telephones around the world. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about stress and health with my guests. They're all these doctors who study stress: Janice Kiekold Glaser, David Kranz, Wendy Barry Mendez, and Faris Tuma. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Kiekold Glaser, you wanted to say something before I almost had to rudely interrupt you. Sorry.
We are talking about how stress and aging may interact, and in fact, it really does appear to be very much the case for the immune system. The immune system is kind of at its peak at puberty, and then it's downhill all the way. One of the happy thoughts for the day.
Talk about a time of stress with puberty.
But quite seriously, when people are over, say, 65 to 70, we really begin to see how much stress can really affect health in particular through a variety of processes, and it appears to be a time where the older someone is, the more they should worry about stress.
Is there a
just expanding, you talked about lifespan differences in the way people respond to stress. There are other differences too, and I think the whole area of identifying which types of individuals are vulnerable, particularly so, is a very important area. For example, I study people who already have heart disease. And there's certain kinds of acute stresses that can produce responses in them and even precipitate a heart attack or cardiac arrhythmia and even sudden death in some individuals. Whereas somebody who did not have that disease, did not have that disorder, was not that vulnerable, that same kind of stress would be fine.
Now, let me ask you a question about that, about different kinds of stress. If you have someone who has, as you say, one of your patients has heart disease, would exercise, which is could be considered a stress, would that be a helpful thing for that person, or would you have to tell them to stay away from that?
Well, in terms of exercise, it really depends on the actual clinical characteristics of disease. But people often equate exercise stress and psychological stress or mental stress, and they're really two different kinds of phenomena. The body's response to exercise is a very adaptive response. The body's response to stress, as I said before, in situations that we encounter now in our daily lives, is not an adaptive response. And even the patterns of reactions that you get physiologically are different between the two.
Mm-hmm. Any hints that anybody can give in this holiday season to have to deal with stress? I mean, I deal with stress by looking at it as theater when it happens. You know, I take myself out of my body and I look at the situation by trying, you know, because that's the silly kind of guy that I am. But I mean, Dr. Kiekold Glaser, any
One of the things we know from a lot of research in personal life is that close personal relationships are so important. When people are stressed, one of the things that often goes are time spent talking with people about how you're feeling, time spent talking with close friends, and that's the very kind of thing that matters most.
On the other hand, when Uncle Joe comes and brings that argument he's had for the last 30 years up again, you know, when he's stuck in the house for a week with you.
This is an issue.
That's a different kind of personal relationship.
True.
Okay. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go here to the audience. Yes. Step up to the mic.
Hi, I'm Anjali from Walt Whitman High School, and I was wondering if there's a genetic predisposition for feeling stress.
Yeah, that was a good question. I mean, distress and for dealing with and for the aging problem, obviously since there's so much in the genes, can you actually observe it in a family? Can you tell? You know, one family can handle it, members can handle it better, Dr. Krantz?
Well, there's at least two issues. It's a complicated issue. One is presumably the genetic issue, and there have been family studies of individuals in terms of their physiologic response to stress, and there tends to be a genetic component. Mm-hmm. And there's another important component here, and that's something that psychologists call temperament. And these tend to be personality characteristics that have a biological component. And individuals with different temperaments not only will deal with stress, mm-hmm. but there are even some temperaments, like extroversion, where people seek stress, and there is a genetic basis for those kinds of characteristics.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Derek in Ashland, Oregon. Hi, Derek.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. In January of this year, I was buried in an avalanche, and about a week later at an avalanche awareness, level one avalanche awareness course, we were standing around a snow pit, and somebody stepped in it, stepped just right, and it made a sound that triggered for me a quicker heart rate, and I could feel my blood pressure rising. And it was just a trigger from back when I was under the snow and a sound that it made. And while I felt really relieved to be coming out of the snow, I was surprised at the response that sound brought back. And I was also surprised by the level of depression that I experienced in the winter, like following that. And I thought somebody there might have a comment
Dr. Tumor, is this post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, so thank you for your call and for sharing your experience. I think the positive message here for this caller hopefully will be that, as I mentioned at the beginning, this kind of response, particularly in the time period he's talking about, is pretty understandable. And if one can do that, they should take some solace in the fact that this is likely to be sort of an anticipated response that he might have to the sound or some other cue in the environment. And in all likelihood, he's going to be fine. Now, having said that, if he continues to experience these kinds of upsetting reminders or experiences where you feel like, again, the danger is happening when it's not, it's probably worth consulting with someone who can help in resolving that. And that was one of the points I wanted to get to, which was we used to think of this disorder and this condition as a problem of forgetting what happened, when in reality it's looking more and more like it's an issue of needing to relearn, retrain the brain to make an association between, let's say, clouds in the sky or a very windy day doesn't mean that there's going to be another hurricane, or planes flying low in the sky doesn't mean that there's going to be another crash or an attack. And this process psychologists refer to as extinction is turning out to be a very important tool, both clinically to understand how we can help people who go on to develop the disorder, but also maybe in understanding vulnerability. It may be that there are some people who are more predisposed to becoming conditioned. Mm-hmm. And one of the exciting areas of research that's taking place right now has to do with combining talking therapy and some medications that might speed up this process, which we can relearn or retrain our brains to interpret cues from the environment.
Derek, have you sought any help on this?
Well, you know, I found that talking a lot with friends was pretty therapeutic as well as time. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but that's how it feels. I would say that one of the benefits that that I take from it is the reminder of how tenuous all of this is, and just to capitalize on the things that one wants to do while you're here. Mm. And as I'm waiting a Peace Corps invitation, I'm thankful for the event that has reminded me of that.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks for calling. Have a happy holiday. Dr. Tuma, did you want to react to that?
Just one final comment on that, which was, you know, we talked about the potential to find something positive in stress. This is another phenomenon in the study of post-traumatic stress, is that people who are able, after their ordeal, to find something positive, whether it is a greater appreciation for life or friends or family, by and large do pretty well. This may also be one of these factors that protects people up front, people who have a personality trait or a sort of hardiness, and tend to see the world through optimistic lenses, may do better in the long run as well.
Let's go to the audience here. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, hi. I'm Ioana from Warwick Mill High School, and I had a couple of comments that were relating to what you said about the perception of stress. Because to me, I mean, when you said, you know, you were standing in line, you're thinking, oh my God, I'm late, I have to get that present, or the person will be mad at me. It's not about that. All you have to do is, or at least in my way, sort of step back and see the grander scheme of things. That it really doesn't matter if you're 10 minutes late. That person will know that, you know, you love him or her because of the effort you put in. And same with college. I mean, I'm a senior right now. I'm applying to college. Well, Wilmot High School is supposed to be a very competitive school, and everyone's freaking out about college. And the truth is that it does matter where you get in, but it mostly matters that you're flexible, that you know who you are, that wherever you go, you're going to do the things you want to do, and you know, discover the things you want to discover. And it's true that college matters, but there's some bigger things and appreciation for life that is, you know, I think determines the things at the end.
A budding psychologist here. Thank you for sharing. See, no question. Thank you for sharing that with us. Yes, Dr. Kranz.
I want to pick up on her comment, and that one of the very exciting things is that there's a lot of power to the person in the whole idea that you can modify your perceptions and change your stress reactions or lower your stress reactions. And this can be done by individuals. First of all, these responses are totally normal, and it's not a matter of psychopathology or mental illness. Psychologists can help you with this, but you can help yourself with it as well.
Just decompressing exercises, you know, quiet or Wendy,
But I was just talking about thinking.
And I was just going to add that I think this was an excellent example of the person in the situation. So she just described being in the same stressful situation, waiting in line, having tons of things to do. But she's appraising this as, in terms of her general life, this is not so important. She's keeping the focus on the forest and not the trees, and she's approaching it with an optimistic attitude. I mean, I think that is when we think about the person in the situation, That's what we're talking about. Yeah. And I think I would predict she's going to do quite well because of that optimistic outlook.
More time to listen to your iPod while you're standing there, right? Instead of, let me go to the audience here. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Jack from Walt Whitman High School, and I was wondering, so far you've been talking about primarily the two kinds of stress, the one where you have a great deal of work or you're inconvenienced somehow, or the time when you're under, you know, bodily threat from, you know, exterior source. I was wondering, wouldn't there also be a different degree of stress when you have a situation where you're the primary caretaker of a chronically ill person, if you're, you know, constantly worried about their condition as well as the work that you have to do to keep them well?
Interesting. Very interesting question. Dr. Kiko Glaser?
We've done in working with Ronald Glaser, with whom I share a close working relationship, we have a long-term series of studies looking at spouses who are caregiving for a spouse with Alzheimer's disease. And what we find is that the long-term stress really takes a big toll. Caregivers respond more poorly to influenza vaccines than non-caregivers. They heal wounds more slowly. And the changes over time in their inflammatory response are about four times as steep as the non-caregivers. And even more perhaps alarming is when people stopped caregiving and they were older, things didn't always return to baseline. So we think in some ways people may with longer-term stress age their immune response as well.
Are there any signals that your body can give you that you can tell, I'm being stressed out, I should really look to get some help here?
When people are sleeping poorly, it's probably the most obvious sign and the quickest way to see it. Mm-hmm. When people get sick easily, when they find themselves inattentive to daily tasks, when they find themselves uninterested in their daily life, things that have brought them pleasure before, mm-hmm. those are all clues that when exercise and eating get dysregulated.
What about the other physiological, the sweating, the other headaches or dizziness, things like that?
All of that certainly evolves with the stress response as well. Just about everything seems to get worse with stress.
You could just say everything is stress these days.
You could.
And you'd probably be right.
It's absolutely true. In many ways, we know so much more about what stress does to you, and that it's an important thing to keep an eye on.
We're talking about stress this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Mendez, did you want to add to that list?
I just wanted to add that the difficulty, though, with sometimes looking within your body is you might miscalibrate. So there are times when your heart beating fast might be part of that approach response. So I think you also want to look at, once the stressor's over, if you are staying elevated and you still feel like your heart is beating fast, once you're done with your deadline or you're done with the argument with your spouse, the extent to which you're not recovering, I think that is probably one of the best indicators that you're probably having more the negative or threat response.
Dr. Kranz.
It's an interesting feature of results in stress response in the stress literature that whether a person feels badly, whether a person has a physiologic response like a rapid heart rate or increased blood pressure, and whether a person's actual performance on their job or elsewhere or relationships or whatever are disrupted, they don't always change the same way, and they don't always go up and down in the same direction. So there may be some people, you were asking before, how do I recognize whether I'm under stress? Let me look to my body. There may be people who feel fine in those circumstances. There may be individuals who are terribly anxious, may even be shaking, and their performance is excellent.
Right.
So, you know, there are different markers and measures, and it's not always looking to your body. It can be looking at how you feel. Mm-hmm. It can be looking at how you fare in daily life, your performance.
Mm-hmm. And our lives are so surrounded by instant answers like medicines, all these anti-anxiety pills that the people are willing to sell us and very quickly get rid of our stress. But could that actually mask a problem? I mean, could those things actually give you temporary relief but not take away the stressors and be a problem? Anybody want to?
Well,
Dr. Tuma,
I'll
jump into that. In
a
psychology meeting, talking about psychiatry, let's see.
This is good because I have a certain degree of comfort here because I'm neither a psychologist nor a psychiatrist. My background is in public health as an epidemiologist, and we all know the definition of an epidemiologist. Right?
Our crowd does, yeah.
Yeah. This is somebody who's broken down by age and sex.
you know how to relieve the stress in this room, I guess.
One of the concerns we have, of course, is both the overuse potentially of some medications as well as the tremendous underuse. And making sure that somebody is taking medication when they can truly benefit from it is a very important point. And it's true that a lot of the medications that are prescribed for depression and anxiety and other very common conditions, we don't truly know the mechanism by which they work and with their fixing the problem, which is why you often see a combination of some of the medications which help alleviate some symptoms with talking therapies that can, as I said before, help people resolve their perception of the stress and to relearn how to put that experience, if it was a traumatic one, or more routine things, into perspective.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more about this. We'll take more questions from the audience. Stay with us. We're talking about stress this hour with Janice Kikolt-Glaser, David Kranz, Wendy Barry Mendes, and Faris Tuma. If you're stressed out in the audience, step up to the mic. We'd be very happy, but no personal questions. One thing we do not do on Science Friday is unethically try to solve your stress problem. In general, we will, but not in these cases. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about stress this hour. We're broadcasting from the American Psychological Association Science Leadership Conference in Washington. Very unstressful situation here in our audience. Let's go to the audience and see what's on their minds. Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm Warren Bickle from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, and I wanted to follow up on a point that started before the break when we started talking about medications, and I want to take that over to substance abuse. Could the panel reflect on the relationship between stress and stress disorders and substance abuse and substance abuse disorders?
Anybody want to tackle that? Dr. Grant?
Well, I can start. It's clear in some anxiety disorders that there's what's called a comorbidity. In other words, people with anxiety disorders self-medicate. There's a comorbidity with alcoholism and the like in many stress-related types of problems. And perhaps Dr. Tuma wants to talk about substance abuse and post-traumatic stress disorder, especially veterans and the like.
So I have two comments, I guess. One is some findings from a very large study that's been ongoing in the United States called the National Comorbidity Survey. It tells us several things about this. One is, was just pointed out, that there is high comorbidity or co-occurring conditions with anxiety and depression with alcohol and other drugs. One of the reasons that's so important is that we see some delays in people's behavior in terms of trying to get help for these conditions when they are impacting their lives, meaning that if somebody has depression or an anxiety disorder, there's typically, on average, a couple of years go by before they might seek out help. If layered upon that, there is a substance abuse or dependence problem, sometimes we can see that time period doubling, in some cases becoming extraordinarily long. And this is a dangerous combination, obviously, for many reasons, because it has the potential to really unravel people's lives. And in the case of conditions like PTSD, particularly among some high-risk populations, and we might think of people who, by virtue of their jobs, are in danger, we know that there are fairly high rates of co-occurring problems, largely in many cases alcohol abuse and dependence. And it is very true that, you know, talking with people who have these conditions, one learns very quickly that for some period of time it was used as a way of trying to cope with difficult sleeping, with getting in arguments, being irritable, being reminded of things that they'd rather not be reminded of. So the recommendation typically is that there is treatment that takes place both for the anxiety or the depressive disorder as well as for the conditions related to alcohol or other drug use.
Are there some cultures that don't have as much stress as we do and don't need to find that, we know how to cope with whatever stress that we get? Dr. Kiko Glaser, I mean, you see, like, people do yoga and, other Eastern cultures, they've developed ways of not taking pills, but of, doing exercises or things like that. And do these things work?
It's interesting you ask. We're trying to start a study now on yoga to actually answer that question. Everybody says yoga is good for your immune response. It can be very helpful and beneficial, but in fact, we really don't have good data on that very question. So we're bringing people into the hospital research floor, and we're putting a catheter in their arm, and we can actually draw blood as they go across a yoga session. So we can look at changes in stress hormones and immune function as they're going through a yoga session, through a mild movement session where they're doing the same thing, where they have the same metabolic demands, and then when they're watching a fairly boring videotape another time.
Yeah. Could you do that with meditation and other kinds of?
People have tried. One of the problems that is true for many studies is that people who choose to meditate are different in many ways from people who don't. If you look at, for example, studies on transcendental meditation, after about 6 months, the people who have voluntarily chosen to learn the skill, only about 15% will still be practicing. Mm-hmm. So in our yoga study, we're actually going to take a look at both naive practitioners or beginning practitioners and very experienced people, too, and see if there are differences, because over time, people may retrain themselves.
Does exercise actually help deal with stress?
Hugely.
Yeah, and how much exercise do you need? Do you need, 30 minutes a week to 20, 30 minutes a day? What are we talking about? What kind of exercise? Walking? Does it have to be jumping jacks, Pilates, whatever it is, or does it not matter what it is?
Any kind of exercise is probably good. The evidence for exercise and immune function is wonderful. The people who exercise regularly in terms of aging will do better. But beyond that, I'm not good in terms of answering the question, and perhaps others.
Yeah, but in general, everybody would agree that Dr. Kranz, it relieves stress.
Yeah, well, I would especially emphasize aerobic exercise. That is exercise where you get your heart rate up and keep it up, like walking or jogging and the like, as opposed to weightlifting. It could be possible that a person can feel good about themselves and their body by doing these other kinds mm-hmm. of non-aerobic exercises. But what's been shown best, and certainly in terms of cardiovascular reactions, is really aerobic exercise.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the audience. Yes, ma'am.
Linda Hayes, University of Nevada, Reno. It seems like stress could be the name for a particular pattern of biological and behavioral interactions with the environment, or it sounds like you're saying it is the cause of those things. And I'm wondering which way you think it is and whether or not how you look at it has any effect on the approach to treatment.
Anybody? Dr. Kurt? Kranz? Okay.
Again, the way I look at stress, and these are regardless of the way people define stress, it seems as though there are a number of commonly accepted things. There's something in the environment that's involved. Your perceptions are involved, and there are consequences, whether it's your behavior or your physiology. Mm-hmm. Now, some people tend to deal with the environment. In other words, when people used to, before there were drugs for treating high blood pressure, the cure was bed rest. Stay out of stressful features.
Right.
Get out of your environment. What psychologists do a lot is something called cognitive therapy, which alters your perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some therapies like presumably meditation or exercise, which work on the physiologic responses. And the interesting thing is that sometimes by changing that one response will affect the other characteristics as well.
So a lot of times you hear people saying, I need a good laugh, you know, and that just changes your whole mood and your reaction to stress. And what was that famous Norman Cousins thing where he laughed himself to health?
Yes, and there was even a recent study, which is very interesting, which showed that a short period of laughter affected certain kinds of cardiovascular responses that are important in terms of coronary artery disease.
Hmm. Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Rich from Georgetown Prep. You've talked a lot about how stress is a negative thing, and you were talking earlier especially about like attacks on you or on your physical well-being. But isn't dealing with stress one of the most important things in today's society, whether it's in your job, like you're a firefighter, or whether you're working in an office and you need to get something done, you're under the gun? And the maxim is practice makes perfect. Well, how do you deal with that? If stress is a negative thing, but you need to be able to deal with it to be able to do well.
What do you do to deal with stress?
I play guitar.
There you go. Should have brought it with you. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Rich, I think that's a great point because experience and exposure with stress, we should think of stress like a muscle. And the more that we've sort of built up that muscle, the more we're able to counter attacks and other stressors later in our life. So we do differentiate that stress that is going to protect us and possibly make us resilient. And to the extent that you have more of a resilient or positive response, we think that it might be associated with hormones that are associated with restorative processes that would blunt the effect of aging. So I think that's a really important part of stress because as important as PTSD research is and caregiving stress, for most people, it's our daily hassles and stressors that we're dealing with. And to the extent that you can deal with those effectively, then that is likely to keep you younger and healthier and thinking more creatively and having better cognitive performance.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, our kids are playing video games. I mean, odd end. And are these stressful situations or are these relaxing situations? And will we not know that till 10, 20 years down the road? I mean, Dr. Mendez?
So we actually use Tetris in my studies that we're just starting up. And the idea is that for people who enjoy it, who find it that positive challenge, the demands of the situations are overcome by what they bring to it. For them, it's exciting. So even though the situation might be demanding, they're enjoying it. They appraise it as a challenge, and
so
and
even though you're
case,
if you're sweating and your palms are sweating, that's not a what you'd consider a negative stressful situation.
It would depend on their psychological state, and
right.
that their psychological state. If it's more of an approach state, then we would expect different cardiovascular and hormonal differences based on that different positive stress response, and that's going to have a completely different trajectory for them emotionally. For them in terms of their thinking and their creativity.
I predict 40 years from now we're going to see a rash of arthritis of the thumbs. I'm serious about that. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Arna Cohen from Alexandria, Virginia. And we've all seen the ads in the paper and on TV that stress produces cortisol, and the cortisol makes you fat, and that's my excuse. And buy these magic pills, and you'll lose lots of weight. So before I run out and spend a lot of money, can somebody talk to me about that?
Dr. Mendez?
Let's just say the science isn't totally in on this, but if you listen to those ads, what they promise is that your pants will fit looser. So the idea is that when you have more cortisol, you're more likely to build up fat around the belly. So the idea isn't that you distribute your weight more down on your hips and thighs if you take these drugs. But let me again say, the science is not in on these particular ideas. But that's what those drugs are promising, is to counteract the cortisol. So you won't necessarily lose weight, but you won't have as much belly fat.
Are those over-the-counter drugs
yes.
that we're talking about? It could very well be that it's today's version of snake oil.
Ah, well, but your pants are fitting.
Right.
Buy bigger pants. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Stephen Corley from Alexandria. And some of the stuff I've read in the pop media is said of the influence on faith, on immune system and recuperation and stress reduction. What I see this as a larger, just a worldview that's optimistic and seeing basically that you have a purpose here. What I'd like to have is some further comments on that is how you see that effects.
Faith causing less stress and
giving
you a purpose
a belief,
so you feel?
Yeah, belief in purpose and life.
Dr. Grant?
There is a literature on religiosity and church attendance and its relationship to heart disease. And people who attend church frequently and people who are higher on religiosity tend to have less heart disease. Now, there are many ways that you can interpret this, and the way that I choose to look at it is that the sense of comfort, the sense of social support that people get from participation in those activities really operates to reduce their stress, just as those factors operate to reduce stress in other kinds of circumstances and situations.
We're talking about stress this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Yes, sir. Don't be afraid.
I'm Tim from Walt Whitman High School. And back to a question that Ira asked, I was just wondering if video games kind of, I could see them as relaxing, but now today's video games are really different. They're more engaging, and I could see that they could actually cause stress instead of
Give me an example of those games.
off the top of my head, World of Warcraft, very popular mm-hmm. among everyone these days. So mm-hmm.
I see all your classmates are nodding in agreement on that.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if it's possible that it could induce stress from a video game.
Dr. Mendez, you don't think so?
It could. I mean, to the extent to which, why would you keep going back if it's really stressful? I mean, so when we're talking
about... The adrenaline rush.
Right. So to the extent that that's perceived as something that you're enjoying, it could be that you're not experiencing sort of the negative effects of stress. It's hard to say because I'm not sure.
But doesn't continuing adrenaline also give you, isn't there a problem, Dr. Kranz, from too much adrenaline?
Yes, there is. Adrenaline affects many things in the body. Presumably, first of all, my comment on video games is it probably affects grades in school because they're spending all the time playing
video games.
And that
leads to a different kind of stress.
Different kinds of stress.
I see.
But there are effects, long-term effects of adrenaline or epinephrine on the body. These are what we call episodic changes. And there have been studies, and Dr. Mendez has probably conducted those, which show very, very large increases in blood pressure and very, very large increases in epinephrine produced by these short-term stresses. The question is, really, is it prolonged enough to have a sustained effect on the body.
Shouldn't we be studying that? Is somebody studying what happens to kids? That would be an interesting study. Yeah.
You mean specifically with video games?
Yeah. Video games.
Well, I think we think of stress as more general, but you're right. To the extent that video games are sort of creating these adrenaline rushes, and to the extent that you're not recovering from that, that's important because it is showing us that the cumulative wear and tear on our bodies, that's what we think of when we think of the bad stress, that cumulative wear and tear hurting our bodies and sort of reducing its capacity to be efficient, that's sort of the idea that why stress is making us vulnerable to diseases related to exacerbating certain disease states.
Mm. And if you have no feeling that you can escape a stressful situation, if your personal life, Dr. Tuma, is such a way that you feel like you're locked in.
I was going to offer the comment that at least my own take on this is when you have two factors or characteristics of stress or stressful situations might be the predictability and controllability.
Yeah.
And either one of those might be, in other words, you might encounter things on a daily basis even that are predictable, but they may be sort of uncontrollable, or vice versa. You can't predict it, but once it happens, you can control it. When you have the double whammy of unpredictable and uncontrollable and significant enough to elicit this stress response where you might see the response system kick in and a bathing, if you will, of certain neural circuits in these neurotransmitters, which turn on the heat, if you will, in our brains. This is where we have some concern.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there because we've run out of time. I'd like to thank Faris Tuma, Chief of the Traumatic Stress Research Program at the NIMH in Bethesda, Dr. Janice Kickholt-Glaser, Professor of Psychiatry and Psychology at Ohio State University School of Medicine, David Krantz, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Medical and Clinical Psychology at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, and Wendy Barry Mendes is Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard and Cambridge. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick in New York, Kevin Waite, Alexandra Gardner, Marty Curcius, and Michael Schweppe in Washington. Thank you all for being with us here today. I'd like to thank everybody in the audience for taking time to stop by out of the American Psychological Association meeting with my mouth not working anymore. Have a great weekend. We'll see you all next week. I'm Ira Flatow in Washington.